Thank you, and my welcome and good morning to everyone as well. We appreciate you taking the time to be on this call. We will be posting a statement on our position on this bill on our website. We also will have a copy of the Informa analysis that we're going to run through with you posted on our website, and an audio version of this call will also be posted on the website, or you can call into the office if you'd like to get a copy. We're going to hear first from Paul Bertels, who is on staff at National Corn Growers. He's our Director of Agricultural Economic Analysis. He's going to just share some highlights of the study that we recently received. This is a study we commissioned by Informa Economics to look at the House bill on cap and trade, H.R. 2454. Following Paul, we've asked John Doggett, who's connected in out of our D.C. office. He's our Vice President for Public Policy, to give a little bit of his perspective from the D.C. View on this bill and some of the other things that are going on surrounding cap and trade. And then we'll hear from Darren Enan, who's connected from Hurley, South Dakota. Darren is our president this year. He's a farmer there in Hurley, South Dakota, and Darren will share our official position and statement, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. So, Paul?
Well, thank you, Rick, and good morning, everybody. I'm Paul Bertels. I'm the Director of Economic Analysis for the National Corn Growers, and I'd like to take just a couple minutes to give some of the highlights of our study. Basically, the National Corn Growers, we hired Informa Economics out of Memphis, Tennessee, to conduct a study titled The Potential Impacts of Cap and Trade Policy on U.S. Corn, Soybean, and Wheat Producers. If I could, just right up front, I'll give the bottom line findings of the study, and that is this. There will be production cost implications resulting from increased energy prices that stem from cap and trade, and specifically H.R. 2454. Yet there will also be opportunities for some farmers, and I emphasize some farmers, to gain despite these cost increases by participating in carbon offset activity. The study basically goes into it and looks at, gives an overview of basically H.R. 2454, how we got to where we are in some climate legislation. And then it goes into some key things, and I think the Informa study, based on a number of the studies that I've read, I think Informa is far and away one of the best studies out there because of the in-depth nature that they looked at. And particularly they looked at cost of production increases. They looked at the ability for farmers to actually participate in offset programs. And then they also did a brief analysis on acreage diversions because of some of these policies. Throughout the study, Informa did not come up with their own energy cost increase, but they did a literature review of about 8 different studies out there. And throughout the study, what they used was the cost that came from the Department of Energy's Energy Information Agency, and that base case was then used throughout the study. So, for example, using the EIA's basic number, in the year 2020, they assume a carbon price of $40.75 a ton. Now, what that would mean to fuel prices is, for instance, diesel price would increase about 33 cents per gallon from what it would off their just normal baseline projection, and natural gas would increase almost a buck and a half per 1,000 cubic feet. One of the key questions that comes up in this, and how does this impact agriculture, is what who's going to get these allowances that the bill speaks of. Now, in specific, we're concerned about what's called the energy-intensive trade-vulnerable enterprises. In the bill, they give an example would be nitrogen fertilizer manufacturers. One of the key questions that comes up is, will nitrogen manufacturers in the U.S. in fact get these allowances, and will they get a sufficient quantity of allowances to offset any increase in nitrogen costs? With that, these allowances are then supposed to phase out starting about 2025. So what we do know is that over time, the cost of fertilizer, and that's a key component in corn production costs, will go up. Just to kind of give you an example of what we think those costs of increase will look like, in the early years, assuming the nitrogen manufacturers get all of the necessary allowances and use those and pass those savings on to growers, the cost of production of corn would probably go up about $2, maybe $2.50 an acre. Now, if those allowances don't come through, we'll see that cost of production increase be closer to about $10 per acre. So it's a fairly dramatic increase in the cost of production. As we get into those out years, and particularly as those allowances to the nitrogen manufacturers go away, we'll see the price of or the cost of production of corn could go up to about $50 per acre, in addition to what we're seeing now by the year 2035, which was the last year of the study. So what we know from this study is that, in fact, cost of production for corn, for soybeans, and for wheat will go up for every growers under this under the cap proposal. Now, in this bill, they've also suggested there are a number of offset opportunities for growers to actually capture carbon and then participate in some kind of market yet to be defined that would trade these carbon back to emitters. Some of the key ones that we looked at were, afforestation of cropland, basically taking current cropland and planting trees. Such things as going into continuous no-till production, improved fertilizer management, improved pasture management, things like that. For this study, Informa basically just limited their analysis to the biggest and most likely one that most farmers could participate in initially, which would be the change over to continuous no-till cropping. Now, one of the areas where I think sets the Informa study apart from all the others that are out there is Informa really went and started looking at how likely is it that farmers across the country will be able to go to continuous no-till. And that's a key point that must be emphasized. It's continuous no-till, not rotational no-till. Many farmers in the Midwest will plant corn under some kind of minimum tillage practice right now, and then in the following year they'll go ahead and no-till soybeans in, for instance. That would be considered rotational no-till. Continuous no-till would be no-till every year for probably at least 5 years, regardless of the crop that's planted. After doing a number of studies, or looking at studies of yield curves, what Informa has noticed is that there is, in fact, a yield drag in early years as farmers switch to continuous no-till. So since there is a yield drag, that, in fact, would be considered a cost. In addition to that, there are areas that they've identified where continuous no-till just does not work as a tillage practice, and that's the key thing. So as their study went forward, they built in some assumptions on the maximum amount of cropland that will be put into continuous no-till. So, for instance, in the heartland, which is basically the center of the Corn Belt, they assumed that the maximum participation in a continuous no-till would be about 60% of the farmers. Now, when you get down into some of the southern and South Atlantic areas, they figured, continuous no-till probably works a little bit better in that area, and they bumped that up to about 90%. Conversely, when you get into the more northern climates, the northern Great Plains, or what's considered the Northern Crescent, which you can assume is basically Wisconsin, Michigan, the northern part of Ohio, across into New York and Pennsylvania, they notice a much lower adoption rate of continuous no-till. Now, last week, just kind of, we had a policy and priority meeting here in St. Louis, and we asked about 100 growers that were in attendance, at what price would you be willing to switch to continuous no-till? And the numbers, although this wasn't a scientific survey, kind of support what Informa's assumptions are. Until we got up to about $100 per acre, that's when we finally saw about 70% of the growers would be willing to adopt a continuous no-till, or those that are currently already doing continuous no-till. But even at that, about 30% of the growers in the room said, I would not switch to continuous no-till at any cost, and I'm certain they base most of that off of just agronomic reasons in their area. So once you combine the increase in cost of production with the possibility of selling offsets back, you come up basically with a net revenue. And what Informa noticed was on these net revenue impacts, growers that can adopt no-till more easily, or in, you know, or they're in the southern areas, they tend to have a higher net revenue impact, a positive from HR 2454. Conversely, if you're in one of the more northern climates, you tend to see a negative net return from HR 2454. Now, just looking at the average corn producer in the Heartland area, what we noticed was once you get into the out areas, there was a slight positive, and I emphasize that, there was a slight positive net return from this bill. But we're talking somewhere in the order of maybe $7 to $9 per acre on corn production from the cap and trade. So, you know, by and large, I would not say this was a major decisive win for farmers, particularly in the Heartland. At the same time, those growers in the northern climates, particularly in Michigan, Wisconsin, northern Ohio, those growers, if they ever saw a net positive, it would probably be in the magnitude of about a dollar. Finally, one of the things that we asked Informa to look at was the question of acreage diversion. As you know, this has been a rather contentious topic. The USDA came out here in December and said, you know, we're going to see 22 million acres of cropland in the Midwest, you know, particularly in the heart of the Corn Belt, switch to trees. You know, that was greeted with a great deal of skepticism. We asked Informa to take a look at this, and what they noticed was, yes, in fact, there was going to be some land diversion, but it was not going to be anywhere on the magnitude of what USDA had predicted. For instance, we see about 5 to almost 9 million acres going into forest, and we see about another 10 to almost 18 million acres going into perennial crops, particularly, you know, switchgrass, miscanthus, things like that. These crops would be grown primarily for that carbon offset that they produce. In the Corn Belt, we've seen that number is much less than what USDA said, probably on the order of less than a half a million acres of corn ground would get switched out in the Corn Belt to forest, and probably less than 2 million would go into perennial grasses. One of the key things that sets this study apart is when USDA produced their model using a big econometric model, you know, once that model said a farmer would make $1 more planting trees, a farmer would plant trees. Now, we know that just doesn't pass reality tests. So what Informa built into their analysis was farmers would have to make more than $20 per acre to switch to trees, and they would have to be making more than $15 per acre on crops to switch to perennial grasses. So in total, what we saw nationwide is about 5 to 9 million acres of corn ground being diverted into one of these other, what we'll just call a carbon crop. That represents somewhere between 6 and 10% of the acreage in the year 2035. But since this would probably switch more of your marginal ground out first and not your highly productive ground, that would probably only represent about a 4 to 7% decline in production. Still, that is a decline in production. So in conclusion, what I'd just like to leave you with from the study is that the cost of production of corn, soybeans, and wheat will go up, and every farmer will experience that cost increase. Some growers will be able to benefit from HR 24 by selling and participating in the offset market. The key thing is that some growers, not every grower. And finally, we have seen that some land will be diverted to trees and perennial grasses. That's all I have, Rick.
All right. Thank you, Paul. That was Paul Bertels, our MCGA Director of Agricultural Economic Analysis. And as I said earlier, there will be some time at the end to ask questions, and we will be posting or have posted a copy of the Informa study for your reference. It's on our website. Next, we're going to hear from John Doggett, who's our Vice President of Public Policy, and John is calling in from Washington, D.C. John?
Hey, thank you, Rick, and good morning, everyone. This morning, NCGA's joined with a number of other ag groups on a letter to be sent to the Senate later today to support what's known as a disapproval resolution to be offered by Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. This resolution would stop EPA from promulgating rules to regulate greenhouse gases. One of the important things to remember is that the Supreme Court in 2007 ruled that the EPA must, not should, but must regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And this is a situation, the requirement to regulate, that's been a significant driver in the Congress to pass legislation that reduces greenhouse gases. And a number of members of Congress want to avoid a regulatory regime under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases, and so thus that's in part why there's some support in a number of quarters for greenhouse, for a cap-and-trade regime. So that's been a significant driver. It's going to be interesting to take a look at how Senator Murkowski's resolution will do in the Senate, whether it can prevail or not. We're not really sure. It would be very difficult for that to prevail in the House, and it is a situation that would require presidential approval to take that disapproval resolution to fruition. And certainly we don't anticipate that President Obama would sign such a resolution because that, again, would take away the kind of the hammer that has been posed over everyone on this legislative activity. For the last year or so, we've been very involved in the deliberations on a House bill. There were a number of provisions that we advocated and worked on that were added to the bill that improved the legislation. We worked very closely with House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson, who took the lead along with a number of other good friends to get these provisions added to the bill. And when the bill came to a vote in the House, and we need to remember that the bill was some 1,300 pages in length, several hundred pages that were added at the last minute, we supported the Peterson Amendment because we knew what was in it, but because of the size and the complexity of the bill, we took a neutral position pending some discussion and some analysis of what the bill would do, and that's what Paul just gave you. We have been involved with Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan and others to fashion provisions on potential legislation moving in the Senate. Really, probably not very much because it doesn't mitigate or stop the regulatory threat that is still out there. And any bill that's going to pass in the Senate is going to need 60 votes. And I think all bets are off for cap-and-trade legislation likely this year. But certainly at some point, members of Congress will need to evaluate whether a regulatory regime or a legislative effort is going to do more good out in the countryside. So with that, Rick, that's it.
Thank you, John. Now I'll turn it to Darren Enan. Darren is the current president of the National Corn Growers Association. He's calling from Hurley, South Dakota. Darren is a farmer raising corn, soybeans, and the hogs. Darren?
Thanks, Rick, and thanks, everybody, for getting on the call this morning. Most of the things Paul and John covered pretty well, I just want to reiterate and get into our statement. And basically, we as a board have passed a resolution to oppose H.R. 2454, and the reason's kind of been covered. I'll cover those real quick again, and it will definitely increase our cost of production. And in volatile and unstable times, we think that's a detriment to agriculture, specifically to corn growers. Secondly, while this does offer opportunities for carbon offsets, and it does give a chance for some growers in certain regions of the country to possibly use this as a profit center, most areas of the country, including the Northern Plains where I'm at, would be a net loser just because we can't adopt a continuous no-till like the bill has stated. I mean, it would in turn affect our ability to produce and be efficient and use our land efficiently as we can. And lastly, there's going to be diversion of farmland into trees, afforestation, or high energy crops, not to the extent like Paul mentioned and John mentioned to the USDA's model, but there will be some. And in a time when we are talking about energy security and growing food or growing corn for food and fuel, to divert acres into afforestation or some other crop would be a detriment to energy security. And as well as if we're producing less corn to meet our growing and maintain our livestock basis, we feel that, you know, definitely some of that livestock could move to other parts of the world, and that would then get into food security. So it's a broader issue than just what it looks like on the surface. And so, again, we thank Chairman Peterson for his principles. You know, we, as we went through those individually, the one that really set us out was number three in our principles that said it makes economic sense for agriculture. And once we've got our study back and we've been waiting for this study, we've let you as the media know, we've let our growers know that we wanted our own numbers. And so, you know, that really turned the tide. And so, you know, again, we thank Chairman Peterson. We thank our allies in the House for all the work that they've done. But now we've come out in opposition. Overall, our position remains neutral on the Senate side. I think what we've stated here is that if the Senate's going to take up this kind of legislation, we want to be part of the process to make it better, because it needs to be much better than what we currently have. And so that's so overall, our position is neutral on the total idea of cap and trade, but we are specifically opposing the House bill that was passed. And I guess with that, I'll turn it back to you, Rick.
All right. Thank you, Darren. And as a reminder again, anybody that joined late, a copy of our statement on our change in position, a copy of the Informa analysis that Paul highlighted, and an audio version of this briefing will be posted on our website immediately after this call. We're going to now move to the question and answer session, and I will turn it back to the operator.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen,
if you'd like to pose a question at this time, please press the star, then one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you'd like to pose a question, please press star, then one. Our first question comes from Chris Clayton.
Thank you for taking the questions today, guys. I have two questions. First, would you guys say then would make the bill better in the Senate for agriculture? And second, did the analysis at all take a look at all at the 20% renewable portfolio standard in the bill and what that would do in terms of adapting more wind energy in rural America and biomass opportunities for farmers to sell biomass from their farms as well?
Darren, do you want to take the first part? Maybe Paul take the second part?
Sure. To make the bill better, I guess I'll start from my standpoint as a grower in the upper Midwest, Northern Plains. You know, obviously, continuous no-till does not work for me, so I would be a loser. So we have to develop a system whereby we can get credit for doing the minimum tillage or for doing more to protect our land in sensitive areas. Try to think my way through this here. You know, the big thing is keeping costs down. You know, what assurances are we going to have that the bill is not going to change that would affect our suppliers of our products, whether it be fertilizer, fuel, equipment, you know, some of that, you know, we need to see a definite positive gain. And, you know, just to have marginal gains financially at the expense of possibly reduced yields, I mean, that's where we got to be. In our mind, you know, this is more about cap and trade, about changing American agriculture to the detriment while increasing agriculture opportunities in other places of the world, for example, because if we're producing less here, somebody will pick up the slack. And so that part, we don't want to downsize American agriculture. We want to continue to be the most efficient, sustainable that we can be in a positive environmental way. And so we think that the bill should be more along the lines of energy conservation, more use of renewable fuels. That would be a true effect on the climate, if that's really the goal here, versus just the way our study looks, just at the expense of agriculture and downsizing American agriculture.
Thanks, Darren. And I'll just add, we do have, this is Rick, we do have a cap-and-trade task force that's made up of some of our grower members, and one of the things our board did when they took this position was ask that task force to go out and answer that very question. What do we want to see in the Senate bill? We said what we don't want. What do we want to see? And they're to report back to the board within the next 7 days on some of those things. So we'll have more definitive information next week. And Paul?
Thanks, Rick. And this is Paul. Chris, to your second part of your question, specifically, no, we did not look at things like wind. On as far as the biomass in the study, what they looked at is just the carbon offset payment, not a price of selling actual biomass. So if you were going to pale switchgrass, for instance, they didn't look at that, because I'm not exactly sure, you know, as you go into some of these out years, what price would you assign to a bale of switchgrass in 2030? I mean, you can run a projection of what corn prices would be, soybean prices, things like that, but where would you start to run a trend line for biomass? So that, specifically to your question, they did not address.
Okay, ready for the next question?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Gary D. Giuseppe.
Thanks. I'd like to direct this to Darren. Since the House bill was passed, Darren, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your members? Have any quit over this issue? Have any threatened to quit the organization over this issue? And also, what will happen at the upcoming Commodity Classic? How will this be framed in terms of asking delegates to assess policy?
Well, your first question, I'm not sure if any quit our organization. I mean, we have members, we're adding members, and members are losing just through tuition all the time. What we are hearing from our grassroots is there's a lot of frustration with the cap and trade process. It's a very complicated issue, so our goal has been to continue to educate our producers on what cap and trade means on legislation versus regulation, for example. And so, you know, we are hearing from our grassroots. They've been comfortable with us being neutral up to this point, because it has allowed us to try to make it better for agriculture. And obviously, we try to do that through the Peterson Amendment. But at the same time, our grassroots, have been very. At the same time, they've allowed the national to be neutral. In their own states, they've raised questions with the state grower associations, and so it's really been a nice working model where some of the states have opposed the legislation early on, but they've allowed the national group to have the latitude to work through this process to make it better for agriculture. Now we've gotten to the point where, you know, after this study, it just was time to make a stand to say we oppose the House bill. But now we want to go to the Senate side and try to help them build on top of what the House has done so far to make it better for agriculture. And if they can't do that, then I think people will understand what our position will be.
Hey, Gary, this is Rick. Just as a quantitative measure, we did hit an all-time membership record in end of September. We monitor our membership monthly, just over 36,000, and it's leveled off in October through January, that just slightly below that. So we have not seen any erosion in memberships, and actually are at a peak, a high level. So, next question.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to pose a question, please press the star, then one key. Our next question comes from Chuck Abbott.
Well, good morning. This may be directed best toward John Doggett. You said that the corn growers are among organizations writing to Lisa Murkowski, the Alaska senator, about a potential resolution of disapproval. Does this letter assign that Murkowski is dropping the idea of an amendment to legislation today that would block EPA from regulating greenhouse gases?
Well, Chuck, as of last night, late, it was the disapproval resolution was definitely a go, and the amendment on the debt ceiling bill is still somewhat up in the air. I think they're still counting noses.
Okay. Right. How many farm groups are on this this letter?
Chuck, as soon as we can distribute it, I'll let you know, because there's some groups that have yet to respond.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to pose a question, please press the star, then one key. We'll pause one moment to see if there are any further questions. Geniato, your line is open.
This question would be for John, if he's still on the line. And I guess my question is, what's the impact of the timing of this, of the release of this study and your response to it? You know, was it time to coordinate with the Massachusetts election, or, you know, what's the timing of it, I guess?
It certainly didn't have anything to do with the Massachusetts election. We're good, but we're not that good. No, I think it's... You know, it was a study that took longer than we wanted because there were, you know, some, as the study went forward, we realized there were more issues that needed to be looked into. But I think this is, it's not timed for anything specific, but it is, I think, gives us a kind of a baseline of saying, this is what the House bill looks like. We're not going to support something that looks like this.
Okay, if I could follow up with just one other, you know, John, what is the feeling on capital? You know, what impact would the midterms have on the cap and trade? You know, in the House bill is passed on the Senate side, would it influence that at all, or any impact from the midterms coming up in November?
I think it'll all be predicated on what the reaction is, and continue. You know, what kind of reaction there is to the regulatory process as it moves forward, and it will move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Steve Barragona.
Hi, yeah, thanks for doing the call. I'm wondering if you are under any kind of deadline or timeline from the EPA on when they would be doing their regulation.
The regulation, they are working diligently behind the scenes on this. And I think that one of the triggering events will be when they release their regs on cars and light trucks and emissions for those vehicles. I think that's sometime in the next couple of months. And once that comes out, that will be a trigger to move forward on the broader front.
Okay. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is a follow-up from Janine Otto.
Thank you. My question this time is for Darren. Darren, as a pork producer, can you talk a little bit about the impact of feed prices for livestock producers? We just heard that the price of corn would go up, likely soybeans too. So can you address that aspect of the cap and trade?
Well, it'd be a couple areas. And the feed prices... You know, if corn and soybeans go up, that does affect the cost of feed. And so from a livestock producer side, you know, that's a business model that, you know, we and they will have to sort through. I think the bigger issue for the livestock groups, and I'm not the one to get into detail on, would be, you know, greenhouse gas regulations from livestock facilities. I think that should be a bigger concern for them. Moving forward.
Okay, then we appreciate everybody being on the call. Thank you for your time, your good questions. A reminder again, copy of our statement, a copy of the Informa analysis, and very shortly an audio version of this call will be posted on our website. That's www.ncga.com. If you have any questions, please call our office, ask for Ken Colombini. If you need additional information, Ken can be reached at 636-733-9004. And again, thank you very much for your time.